This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking.
Welcome to this BizNews briefing. It is Thursday, the 13th of March, and I'm Bronwyn Nielsen. Well, the BizNews Conference 7 is in full swing here in Hermanus, and there has been an amazing speaker lineup on the stage, including the likes of Deputy President of South Africa, Paul Mashatile, Discovery CEO, Adrian Gore. Yesterday, we heard from UK entrepreneur Aaron Banks, Gayton McKenzie, South Africa's sports minister. We've also seen the likes of Dan Murakani, the CEO of Eskom, taking to the stage. And all of that content will be made available on biznews.tv in the coming weeks. But what I have managed to do for today's show is take a few snippets from the speakers yesterday and bring them to you as somewhat of a teaser, I suppose, for the content when it does come to the biznews.tv platform. We start with entrepreneur Aaron Banks, who shot to fame after the 2016 Brexit referendum, where financial support for the Leave vote made him the UK's largest ever political donor. Here's his take on South Africa's politics and also on Elon Musk in the context of the US administration.
It struck me there's a huge political opportunity for someone in South Africa, but I doubt it's the DA. I mean, from what I can see of what they've done so far in government is just facilitate the ANC to be slightly less worse than they were before. And that's not a dream or an aspiration that South Africans should have. And I think there's a huge gap in the market for someone to come through it that can actually take this country on and fix the issues. Someone's looking for a government to actually do something, you know, put proper water in, build houses, build, you know, electricity, decent schools. They just want decent, you know, outcomes for their families. And I think that's the issue in South Africa, that the first person that comes will actually, a bit like Trump, is prepared to say what they're going to do and do it, is going to do extremely well.
Getting back to the Trump relationship with South Africa, he did make a few mentions of it. Elon, yeah, every now and then tweets about South Africa, always in a negative sense. Is that falling off the agenda now because there are more important things going on?
Well, I think Elon's he's overextended himself, I think is the correct business term. You know, people have stopped buying his cars in Europe, and he's beginning to realize that politics is more powerful than business. And that's the thing that a lot of business people forget, that politics trumps business. You can see he's got, you know, I think that he's going to have to reel his neck in. I also think I just can't see him surviving that long with Trump.
The mayor of Mgeni in KwaZulu-Natal, Chris Pappas, took exception to Banks' criticism of the Democratic Alliance. Here's his response.
So there were some negative, slightly negative comments made by him about the Democratic Alliance, and I do take exception to this, and I'll tell you why. There's one political party that has been fighting for the future of this country, for the history of our democratic history, as well as before that. There's no political party that has spent more money, more time, more effort, and more sacrifice ensuring that our constitutional democracy works. Stalwarts like Helen Ziller and many others who have given up literally blood, sweat, and tears to make sure that we can sit in a venue like this today and debate and discuss the important things that will move our country forward. So I do take exception from someone from the outside coming to criticize my political party, having no blood, sweat, or tears in the game. And you know, Mr. Banks, it's easy to hide behind billions of pounds, but when the rest of us are on the ground, speaking to the poor, speaking to those who are desperate for a government that works, it is easy to call yourself a disruptor. It is easy to call yourself radical. The true radicals, the true disruptors, are those who are trying to break the disruptive nature of poverty and inequality in our country. in a place where that is so diverse, with such a deep history of division, those are the true people who are trying to build a country. So please do not lecture us on how to build our own country, rather focus on your own. In the grand scheme of things, this might seem like a small moment, but to me it was powerful. It was a symbol, a proof that broken systems can be repaired, that what once was broken can work again, that even a country where decay seems to be inevitable, renewal is still possible. At this moment, Alec, with a minute left, I must be a disciplined cadre, as the comrades would say, and say that this would not be possible, specifically in our municipality, if those 42 senior citizens who did not come out and commit to voting for a government that would bring about real change. So I'm asking you to support a political party, whether with your checkbook or with your time and effort, to bring about that real change. Now that that interlude is over. Despite all the challenges that we face, I still believe in this country's future, and that the best days can still be ahead of us. But we have to fight for them. We must remember that history does not move in straight lines. It is shaped by those who refuse to sit back and watch. South Africa is not beyond saving. It is simply waiting for those with the courage to act. So the question then is not whether or not South Africa has a bright future. The question rather is, what will you do to make it a bright future?
Pappas's full speech will be made available on biznews.tv, as well as his subsequent interview with Alec Hogg, the founder of BizNews. Now, Moletsi Mbeki is well known in South Africa. He's an economist. He is a well-known businessman, and he is also a political analyst. He took to the BizNews 7 stage and took a heavy swipe at black economic empowerment. Let's hear what he had to say.
It was not the ANC masses who accepted the policy of black economic empowerment. It was the ANC leadership who accepted the policy of black economic empowerment. Why? Because they benefit from it. But the consequence of black economic empowerment, besides driving corruption, it also is against entrepreneurship, because it drives entitlement. Instead of getting the so-called African middle class to become entrepreneurs, it gets them to become very wealthy from getting shares from existing businesses. Huge amounts of money are allocated into black economic empowerment deals. If black economic empowerment was of any good to the economy of South Africa, we wouldn't be sitting with 40% unemployment, with all these wealthy black people like Cyril Ramaphosa, Saki Macozoma, I don't know who else. These are the beneficiaries of black economic empowerment. Black economic empowerment is a parasite on the existing economy of South Africa. It is parasitic on the economy of South Africa, and it is destructive of value in the economy of South Africa, and it should be gotten rid of.
Again, just to emphasize that I am bringing you snippets from the conference, and all of the content will be made available. Now, Dan Morakani, the CEO of Eskom, assures South Africa that the executives at Eskom and the board at Eskom are not sleeping at all, given the current bout of load shedding in South Africa, as they look to solve the situation.
From an Eskom perspective, the board and the management team are very driven in as far as those three priorities are concerned. You know, we don't sleep. We spend a lot of sleepless nights, and sometimes we have to be reminded that it's a Monday and not a Sunday weekend, because we're really going through on this. We have tasted how it feels to have no load shedding for 311 days. We have witnessed the mood changing in the country. We have seen the perception of the country from an investment perspective change. I spent time on investment roadshows in New York and in London late last year, September or so, and the message is beginning to sink. We need to get to a point where this is no longer an issue from an investment perspective. But we also have to deal with issues around driving an ethical high-performance culture. We have changed our structures internally to ensure that we can bring accountability to bear. Where there's been wrongdoing, that there are actions being taken. We're working with the SIU. We've got other agents of the state that are actually doing work with us. There's a number of forensic work that was done in the last 2-3 years. Those files, as they come now, they arrive in a very focused team that takes decisions and disciplinary actions to employees and to also suppliers, because we also have to address these issues of around accountability and clean governance for our people. But for me, I tell you, we take our responsibility very seriously, and I'm very proud to work for Eskom at this point, given what it means for our country.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
At SunExchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
On the international front, retired U.S. General Ben Hodges says that Putin appears to be putting a spanner in the works when it comes to the Russia-Ukraine peace deal. Our colleagues at Bloomberg have the detail.
Obviously, we are all waiting with bated breath to see what Russia's actual response will be here. With your knowledge of Vladimir Putin, what do you expect he'll say?
Well, Kaylee, first of all, obviously anything that stops the murder of innocent Ukrainian civilians is a good thing. But I think we're all waiting to see whether or not Russia is actually going to accept this opportunity. Frankly, I'm skeptical. I kind of think they're going to drag this out as long as they can to get what they can out of it. I don't believe anybody seriously expects Russia to live up to any sort of ceasefire agreement unless there is a force in place that will compel them to do so. I'm glad that the president has talked about, you know, he might have to put more pressure on Russia, because frankly, up until this point, all of the demands and the pressure have been on Ukraine. But Russia is the aggressor here. They're the ones that invaded Ukraine. And the president does have enormous leverage over Russia. He can stop or disrupt the flow of Russian oil and gas to India and China. He can also tell the Russians that he's going to allow Ukraine to have everything they need without restriction in terms of weapons and ammunition. So the president really does have a lot of leverage.
With all of that said, what can Ukraine do to strengthen its hand, General, before it gets to the negotiating table, presuming that happens?
Well, Joe, I expect that between now and if there is a ceasefire of any sort, they will continue to do three things. Number one, you know, they have stopped Russia in most places. I mean, this war has been going on 11 years. And without the United States or other countries actually committing to helping Ukraine win, Ukraine has stopped Russia. So I think they will continue to do what they have to stop Russia from making any significant gains. Number two, they will have to continue reorganizing themselves and growing the size of their military, making service more appealing to young Ukrainian women and men. And then third, the Ukrainian defense industry has actually grown during the war. And so I anticipate they'll continue growing their own capability to produce ammunition, drones, and other things that they need.
In the U.S., DOGE has taken a heavy hand to the U.S. Education Department, and the cuts are making headlines across the board. Again, our colleagues at Bloomberg.
Will these people ever see the inside of that building again?
Well, they were told that they can come back on Thursday to collect their items. But this is really impacting more than 1,300 employees. And really, after efforts have already been underway for people to voluntarily leave, which we have seen at other agencies. And a lot of the people that I'm talking to at the Education Department feel as though some of the things that have happened at CFPB, the USAID, those things are starting to play out here as well, where President Trump is very explicitly saying he wants to eliminate this department, but he is doing it in a way that is much slower because, of course, there's a lot of things at stake here. They oversee more than $1 trillion in student debt, so they need to make sure they have experienced people staying in the department to continue to oversee some of those really critical functions.
Well, because it's congressionally mandated that the department does so, and you just heard Secretary McMahon making that point, Akayla, that if they really want to undo it entirely, they need Congress's cooperation. So how far realistically can the executive branch take that without lawmakers going along?
But really look at the examples that we've already seen from the CFPB, USAID. Both of those agencies were both also created by Congress. Mm. And yet I think because this agency is a lot bigger, a lot more people are more familiar with it, they're being more careful than they have been with some of these other agencies where we've seen signage removed from the buildings. We've seen other employees pretty much taking over those buildings. So you still have folks in that physical headquarters in Washington, D.C., but they're closing down offices pretty much across the country in places like California. So this is really a sweeping effort, and they're saying they're trying to consolidate all their staffers into one building right now.
Interesting. Well, the DOGE, of course, is a massive topic of conversation all over Washington and now on Wall Street. The president yesterday talked about the DOGE's strategy for cutting the federal workforce at large. Here's what he said.
It's one thing to cut, but we want to cut the wrong people, meaning we want to cut people that aren't doing the job. We want to keep the right people.
Absolutely.
And I said, I don't want to just say we're going to cut 50%. I want to cut the people that aren't doing the job, the people that aren't there, the people that are scamming the system. And he agrees with that 100%.
Do we have any evidence of that sort of fine-tooth comb approach when you talk about laying off half the staff that doesn't smack as being surgical?
Well, at least at the Department of Education, they say that certain parts of particularly this federal student aid office, which oversees that $1 trillion in student debt, that those parts of the of that office in particular have some of those parts have been remained intact. But we have reporting that hundreds of people have been laid off there. And so we're really still waiting to see how that could actually impact the disbursement of aid. And a lot of borrowers are frankly freaking out. They're like, what is going to happen to some of these programs that they have been relying on for years?
Well, and we should point out as well that when it comes to the whole federal government, they're facing a deadline of tomorrow, these agencies, to submit to the Office of Personnel Management plans to cull their workforces, essentially. Akayla, do we have any sense of what those numbers ultimately could look like?
Well, we're starting to see cabinet secretaries really getting out there and talking about their plans to reduce staff. And this is really a jockeying effort we're seeing by cabinet secretaries to really fulfill not only Elon Musk's efforts, but President Trump's efforts, who says he's very strongly supporting Elon Musk. We saw those Teslas at the White House yesterday. So this is very much a whole of government approach. And I think secretaries are frankly competing to show how much they can do.
Still in the U.S., Clayton Swopes, who is the Deputy Director of Aerospace Security Project, details SpaceX's mission to bring two U.S. astronauts safely home.
Clayton, this is a really big moment. Everyone has really become so endeared to Sonny and Butch. What did this tell us about what went wrong, and will this ever happen again?
Well, Jackie, it's funny. I was thinking, too, the one thing that I have as a takeaway is just it's about Sonny and Butch and just their endurance and their patience and their grace. And it's something that I think back on. I think I admire that. I'm sure a lot of Americans admire that and people around the world. And probably you, like me, I get upset when I'm 3 hours delayed at the airport and they've been there since June. So it's a very different thing to think how long that they've been up there and everything that they've been through. But they've had that poise throughout. I think what we've learned, too, is that space really can still throw us curveballs, but that we have gotten to the point where we have flexibility and adaptability, that we can still do human space flight safely and do that at scale. And that's a lot of credit to NASA on the approach that they've taken to get us here, and then also to SpaceX, on whose technology we really relied on to make this happen.
How do you think about the next steps moving forward when it comes to the Starliner? What do you think is the future from here?
Well, there's still a lot of things that we don't know. We do know that Boeing has said they want to stay in the space game. It's less clear on what happens next for Starliner specifically. That will depend a lot on what NASA decides with Boeing about certifying that capsule to fly astronauts again into space. So we don't really know how long that would take. But if we look to the horizon, just with the International Space Station, we're planning for it to deorbit in 2030. So that's less than 5 years away. So there's really only a few more opportunities, really, in the grand scheme to bring astronauts to that station, and that window is quickly closing.
There's been a lot going on in the space field as of late, and I think it has many people wondering, are we in a new space race of some kind? How does the U.S. stack up with what we're doing in the field versus other countries?
It's really hard to not think about China and all their achievements in space. Right now, there's 7 astronauts and cosmonauts on the International Space Station.
Hold that thought for a moment here, because we want to bring our audience some live images of President Trump, who is greeting the Prime Minister of Ireland. The two men are about to take part in a bilateral meeting at the Oval Office. Now, we will bring you those headlines as they come in. You could also check for updates on Live Go on your Bloomberg terminal. Now, Jackie, back to you. Talk to us more about how China is really getting to the space race.
Yeah, there's 3 Chinese astronauts on their space station, Tiangong 3, right now, as we speak. So they've really made space look routine in a lot of ways that America has also been able to do. They're also eyeing the moon. They want to land Chinese astronauts on the moon by 2030. So is NASA. I think it's hard to avoid the notion that this is a space race, maybe a moon race 2.0. The United States is still the undeniable space power, lead space power in the world, but China is definitely nipping at our heels.
Let's talk about who's making us the space power. We hear a lot about SpaceX, but over in Silicon Valley, there's a lot of contenders really coming into the fore as well. What are you seeing in terms of concentration of who's taking us to the next level?
SpaceX is the main player right now when it comes to launch, when it comes to broadband from low Earth orbit, when it comes to a lot of the things that we rely on to get people and cargo to the space station. But there are a lot of other companies that are innovating in Silicon Valley and around the country. You have companies in Pittsburgh and Texas and Florida. They're trying to catch up and come up with new ways to do space, to do it cheaper, to do it more efficiently, to mine asteroids even. So there are a lot of up-and-comers that really will challenge SpaceX's dominance, and it will be their game to lose, though, over time, because there's a lot of smart people, though, right behind them.
That brings us to the end of today's Biz News Briefing. We'll be back on Monday next week with more content on the global and local front. Thanks, as always, for watching.
This Biz News Briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.